That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hello and welcome to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. I'm super excited for you guys to hear this episode, a whole episode featuring the voices of some of my favorite female sports reporters, and I want to thank them so much for giving me their time and their insight. I think this is a super important topic, and I really hope I don't end up just preaching to the choir. So if you start listening and you think, ah, this really isn't for me, it probably is for you. So I hope you keep listening because it's super illuminating. And I would argue that pretty much every problem can get better if we just have some real, honest, thoughtful conversations. And in the case of today's topic, I think there's a real power in having discussions about pervasive issues that maybe we all acknowledge but don't address often enough, especially things that might be conversations had between and amongst the women in the industry, but rarely shared with fans and listeners and colleagues and bosses. Sometimes the things that seem obvious to us and clear are not so to those who don't experience it regularly or who maybe are unwilling and haven't yet given the time to fully listen to what our experiences are like, how things affect us, and what their role in it is. This is a topic that I've been thinking about since my very first days in the sports industry. And it begins with, how do I dress? What do I wear? How will I be seen or interpreted because of how I dress? Continues on to, what are my expectations or limits in terms of bosses' requirements for my appearance or suggestions for my appearance? And then finally, a conversation about how the commentary and interaction between fans and female sports reporters via social media, email, letter, how that actually affects the woman on the other side. And honestly, the reason that I wanted to do this pod, the moment that I knew that I had to do this pod, was when I got home from a really great night at the Chicago Red Stars women's professional soccer game. They had offered to do a Sarah Spain bobblehead night. A bunch of my friends had come out to support me. I did the coin flip. We had a suite. I was signing people's bobbleheads at halftime. It was a really cool moment for me. And before the game, I took a picture with maybe 7 or 8 young girls, probably 7-year-olds, maybe 6. And I was wearing a Red Stars jersey that the team had given me and a pair of jeans. And I posted it on social media afterwards with like hearts and stars and happiness, talking about how it had been such a great night for me to be surrounded by women's professional athletes and to be with fans who were supporting them and empowering them and to talk to these little girls and to feel like I had an influence on them. And one of the first comments when I posted that photo was, oh my God, your boobs. And it's not like it's a new thing for me. I get comments about my chest all the time. But for me to look at the photo, just wearing like a soccer jersey, surrounded by little girls, and to have someone still feel that that's a space to write about my body in that way, and also for that to be where their brain went. And that might sound naive to some of you out there, but I have been naive to the idea that at any moment in my life, whether or not I choose to be a sexual being, I might be looked at that way. And again, you might say, duh, that's how men are or whatever. But I think for me, in everyday life, you might get some catcalls or some comments walking down the street when you don't feel like you're particularly in the mood. You're on your way to work or you're rushing from somewhere or you're sweaty and gross after yoga and you're like, ew, come on. But there's something about social media that takes that feeling and multiplies it so many times over. And it has affected me in my everyday life. I've never been one who really likes to be ogled.
There were even moments early in my career when I was looking around at the landscape, particularly online, where a lot of up-and-coming women like me were trying to get their start, and thinking to myself, this isn't the industry for me if it requires having to dress a certain way or act a certain way or appeal to people in a certain way. And there are certainly jobs that I did or moments where I sacrificed what was comfortable for me, which is really to be the smart or funny woman and not the sexual one, believing that that was the only way to get where I wanted to go.
I, of course, can be a sexual being, and when I want to be flirting or I want to be putting off that vibe, of course I can. But I've not been one who wants to be in public spaces and feel like I'm getting stared at by someone I'm not interested in or looked at in a way that was sexualizing me, especially in moments where that sexuality is somebody else's idea entirely.
not coming from me at all, but what they're projecting onto me. And since I've gotten in the public eye and since I've had to regularly digest an Instagram full of comments about my body or a continual sexualization, objectification of me, even in moments where what I'm doing or saying has nothing to do with that, it's really affected me in some negative ways. And I wanted to talk to other women about it and see if it was affecting them too. And also kind of share that there are probably people out there that really don't understand the effects some of those comments can have. Because the night of that soccer game, I got into it. I kind of went off on Twitter because people didn't seem to understand why I was so angry. And I couldn't accurately explain or get across to some of them how it feels to, even in a moment like that, surrounded by little girls in a t-shirt all the way up to my neck, be reduced to a body part, one body part. So I hope these conversations with some of the great women in our industry talking about how we present ourselves and how we're received might help people better understand the challenges and these themes and ideas of objectification of women, the inability to separate women from their bodies, are clearly not limited to this industry, but are much larger issues that affect society on the whole.
That's what she said.
To open up the conversation, I started with something that seems pretty basic. How do you decide what to wear to be on television? Well, if you're one male news reporter from Australia and you want to spotlight the double standard in your industry, you wear the exact same suit every day for a year, and no one notices. Yeah, this was a couple years ago. An Australian news anchor, after seeing all of the feedback his female co-host got on a regular basis, decided to see what would happen if he wore the same suit every single day. Never changed, did get it dry cleaned. Surprise, surprise, no one noticed because people are far more critical of women's appearances on TV. So I asked some of my colleagues if they ever did or still do struggle figuring out what to wear. Here's what Molly Karam from First Take had to say.
I think what's the most critical part for me now, if I even work with stylists or on my own, is that I always look classy. And that's something that I've paid attention to. I would say as I've gotten older, just because at different points in my career, I think different wardrobe was encouraged, so to speak. But I think now what's most important to me is that if I'm having a conversation, I'm not wearing anything that's distracting, like taking away from the content. So I always want to look professional, and I want to look like I'm going to work, not to the club.
Of course, in addition to looking professional, Molly also said she has to worry about how she's being judged based on her attire.
I want to wear things that are flattering. I'm not the stick figure and my body's curvy. I'm naturally a little bit thicker, so I have to work very hard to kind of, you know, stay healthy, be in shape, all those kinds of things. So that's the other thing. What'll look flattering. Certain tops, I feel like I might look too busty in that. And those are things that I'm trying to shy away from. Sometimes you can't control that.
ESPNW writer Kavitha Davidson understands that all too well.
Yeah, I mean, the number one thing that you always consider is how much cleavage are you showing, right? Because that's the first thing that anybody ever comments on. So you try to wear something that's high-necked, but not so much that you're choking. But I've also found that it doesn't actually matter how provocative or not what you're wearing is. Someone's always going to comment on it. I remember doing OTL once via like satellite camera, and I was wearing just a black t-shirt and I was only shown from the waist up, and someone made a comment to the effect of, Kavitha takes up more than half my screen. Like, I'm wearing a t-shirt, dude. Like, so yeah, it's always a struggle as far as what you're wearing. And I think that you're concerned about every aspect of your looks, especially when you're not used to doing TV. But then when you do, you know, you criticize or you scrutinize every aspect of what you're wearing and how you look.
There's a double standard for big boobs. I'm just going to put it out there. As somebody who has lived with them since the age of about 12, I'll tell you that it's like carrying around two signs that say, treat me like an object. It's hard to find clothes that fit. It's hard to find clothes that flatter you without over-accentuating your breasts. And if you wear something too baggy, then people message and ask if you're pregnant. It's really difficult on camera to sort of balance it. And even when you try to downplay your chest, your boobs are still going to be there. You can't hang them up on a hook outside the door and put them back on when you're done with the TV show. Here's Kavitha again.
There's a really great sex blogger named Lux Alptrum who writes, she's quite stacked as well, but she writes about how, you know, the big boob problem is a huge thing for all kinds of reasons. Finding clothes that fit you, finding clothes that don't look quote unquote slutty on you. We have fewer options as to what we can actually wear that are deemed acceptable by society. And it sounds like a ridiculous problem to have, but it's a very real problem.
The first couple times I did television, I spent more time trying to figure out what I was going to wear than what I was going to talk about. And that's embarrassing to admit, but I had done a little bit of television and I already knew the responses that come if you don't look your best. Kavitha agrees.
You know, the first 20 minutes of getting ready in the morning is, does this fit too tightly? Am I showing too much of my arms even? And I should just be preparing my notes.
NBA reporter for TNT and NBA TV and MSG Network's broadcaster Rebecca Harlow said when she started out, it was all about looking as businesslike as possible, even at the expense of style.
When I first started, I was so worried about making sure that I came across looking professional that I think I wore really frumpy, you know, the old school frumpy suits that we used to wear.
Yes.
I mean, I used to roll in those. And it's funny because it's not anything I would ever want to wear, but I was just so worried about making the right impression that, yeah, I can even literally remember some of them, like the old Tahari, like brown suits with the pinstripes, and they were terrible.
ESPN writer and TV personality Kate Fagan admits that she spends more time than she'd like considering what to wear.
Yeah, I actually, it's something that I think about for longer than I wish. Almost every time either I pack to go up to Bristol or right before doing something, I'm always like, okay, is this hitting the balance between who I am and how I want to represent myself and like a really real version of how I feel? And then also, am I dressing enough with enough quality that it's going to look good on TV? And I'm always trying to strike that balance.
For Fagan, it's also about balancing her personal style with the expectation that many have for what a woman on television should look like.
The main concern, actually, that I always had was footwear. I think when you get into the professional world for women, there's more ways to wear like a pantsuit or pants and a nice blouse that I don't think it looks odd. But what was always so hard to navigate was footwear, because there's always, and I don't know if you know this, Sarah, right? There's this cliche in the gay world, in the lesbian world, that you always know who's gay, who's a lesbian based on their footwear. And so it's always like, if you think their footwear is unstylish, she's probably gay. And so I never wanted to live up to that stereotype, but the only way to combat it for a very long time for me was to wear some like small heel or some kind of piece of footwear where I was trying to feminize myself, but I felt strange wearing it. But then the only choice I thought I had was to wear some sort of flat that then I felt like I was embodying that previous stereotype. So it wasn't until the last few years when somehow I carved out some space where supposedly everyone at ESPN's okay when I wear Nikes, where I really feel like I get to wear what I want to wear and what represents me.
For Jemele Hill, it was about adopting a whole new persona. She said getting into TV made her have to be girly and actually think about what she's wearing.
It felt very weird to be obsessed with that sort of stuff when I had never, to that point in my life, ever been obsessed with what I was wearing or, you know, really thought a lot about it. I mean, one of my least favorite things to do is shop. And so to suddenly go from that being my least favorite thing to being a necessary evil was quite a change of direction.
The thing is, even if you didn't want to care that much about how you look or what you wear or how you style your hair, the fact that it matters so much to other people means it matters. And the fact that it matters so much in the way you are perceived also means you have to be very careful and conscientious of how you present yourself. Here's Jemele Hill again.
Well, the fact that I think we have to be much more aware of our physical appearance, it's a shame, but, you know, people make judgments more so about how women appear physically as opposed to men. As in, if you're wearing something that somebody considers to be risque, they start making assumptions about your personality and about what you're actually trying to quote-unquote sell as you're appearing on camera. So it's kind of, we're put in a very awkward spot because so much, despite the information that we have, despite whatever analysis we bring to the table, there is a fascination and not a good fascination with how we look. And so we're aware of it as we appear on camera. And so we're either, by even thinking deeply about what we're wearing, we're sort of playing into that fascination, but we kind of have to because we realize that TV is a visual medium and that women are judged completely differently.
Relative TV newcomer Mina Kimes, who appears on Around the Horn and writes for ESPN the magazine, is also getting used to the TV thing.
Oh, I definitely still struggle, which is obvious to anyone who sees what I wear on television. You know, I have only really been regularly appearing on TV for, I guess, a little over a year. So I'm new to it, and most of what I've learned is just from looking at other people, right? But you know, what looks good on other people is not always what looks good on me. And the way I dress normally is not the way you should dress on television. So I've kind of had to learn how to, still be myself, but be a better version of myself, or a version that's more suitable for a visual medium. It's definitely like a learn-on-the-go experience for me.
Mina's also getting used to what her attire might say to her viewers about her, even unintentionally.
If you feel that you look good, you feel more confident, and thus you are a better version of yourself in every venue, but I think that's certainly true of television, so I've tried to put some effort into it, so that's something I think about. And then the other thing is, you know, I do think about how it's going to be perceived, and that cuts to the question of sexiness and appropriateness and all of that. You know, those are things that go through my head for sure.
SportsCenter anchor Al Duncan learned the hard way that being accused of not caring enough about how you look can also be a problem.
I kind of have always been one of those people that's like, I'm just going to go with whatever I like, right? And I never thought about how low is this chair? What does my thigh look like in this chair? I guess I probably put a little bit more onus on some of the people in the studio with me to be like, hey, like your butt's hanging out. I have this really fun interview that I did with Kevin Hart that I really enjoyed, and I won't show a person that interview because my dress, which was completely appropriate length when I was standing, right, which is when you try clothes on, that's what you're doing, you're standing. When I was sitting in one of those low comfy chairs in the studio, my entire thigh was out. And I am so incredibly embarrassed because that's not me. I don't wear things to be sexy. I don't wear things not to be sexy. I don't put that much thought into it. I honestly buy things and wear things that I think are cute. It doesn't hurt if it makes me look thinner than I am because it is television. And unfortunately, maybe because I haven't put as much thought into what does this look like when I'm sitting or when I'm doing, at this particular table or facing this way, there is a compilation of my thigh meat. I've been told from a few people, I refuse to Google my name. You get the people who automatically say, you know, who defend you and say you're objectifying this woman. And then ultimately, conversely, you get the people that say, well, why would she wear something like that if she didn't want people to talk about her thighs or to think that she was sexy or to think that she was hot? And it's so pathetic that she feels the need, you know, to not lean on her knowledge, but to lean on her legs. And anyone that knows me knows that the subject of my body and attention on my body is the last thing that I'm interested in. So it's embarrassing that is out there. At the same time, it did force me to pay a little bit more attention to what things look like from every angle on television.
Elle is expecting her first child, and here's what happened when she started to dress a little bit more comfortably for her growing baby bump.
You feel like crap. You feel awful. You're just starting to, like, get a little thicker, and so things aren't fitting as well. And I wore these pants that were so incredibly comfortable and a button-down and a blazer, and immediately the response on Twitter, like in a row, I had four or five people in a row that were like, what are you doing? Like, the only reason I used to watch you or care about you is so I could see you look sexy. Like, it's so pathetic to see that you don't care anymore. What happened to you? I would much rather the trolls that say, I think you're a moron and I hate what you just said and you're stupid and you don't know sports. I'd rather that than the, oh my God, you're so sexy, I'm watching you on mute. And that's all I really need.
Obviously, male reporters just don't have to worry about that stuff. Pregnancy, obviously, but the other stuff, too. You throw on a suit and tie, and you never have to worry about there being a thigh meat compilation or whether you're not trying hard enough. It can be fun to pick out outfits, and some women really enjoy all of the different varieties and options. But as Kate Fagan explains, it does make it that much more a part of the job and that much more time-consuming for women when compared to their male counterparts.
I would say that I'm assuming that most men who give it some thought also want to represent who they are and represent their certain style, but there seems to be a more narrow lane that men have to walk in when they're thinking about what to wear, whereas with women, it's just, it feels like there's so many different ways you can go and so much to choose from, and then you're also trying to balance, like, how you're perceived as a woman with also, are you striking the right chord in the professional manner? So it's, of course, never having been on the other side of it, but even talking to a lot of the guys that I work with, they're always commenting on, like, it seems like there's so many more things and so many more variables that you have to decide from.
And forget about just clothes. The way women are scrutinized, almost every single reporter that I talked to had an example of something very small and almost unnoticeable that they'd gotten picked on for. Here's Rebecca Harlow again.
I, no joke, was told, not at my current network, but at a different one I was working for, I was told that my eyelash was out of place. I mean, eyelash, Sarah, eyelash. not eyelashes, a lash.
Here's Jamal Hill again.
I remember one time I was doing SportsCenter, and I have these knee-high, boots that I really love, and they have ties in the back, and I usually never tie them because I just don't feel like tying them. And so they were untied, and so you could see the string a little bit. It was very... It's very innocuous in my opinion. But nevertheless, I was checking my Twitter feed after the show, and this guy is just ripping me for looking unprofessional because my boots were untied. Mm. He didn't care what I had to say about the calves. He didn't care about any of the information that I was delivering in that newscast. All he cared about was the fact that I looked unprofessional because some innocuous ties in the back of some suede boots were untied.
I've gotten comments on everything from a fingernail being chipped to a change in my eyebrow shape. When I wore a white shirt on a Monday and a white dress on a Wednesday, but I was sitting down and a guy thought it was the same outfit and complained that I didn't bring enough clothes on the trip. Are my earrings too big? Is my necklace too big? Because of the obsession with women's looks, even in a job that's supposed to be about the content, sometimes women are told by bosses to lose weight, change their hair color, or dress differently. It all sounds familiar to Rebecca Harlow.
I've certainly been told what to wear, what to look like, how my hair should be, you know, what my weight should be. I've certainly been told all of that. Like, you know, I've been put through the Barbie car wash before. It is hard because that's not me. Like, I'm an athlete. That's where I come from. And I do want to make this super clear, not at my current network, which I should say. I have nothing but full support from MSG Networks and Turner, and I love that. And I'm definitely at a place in my career where I will only work for places where there is that mutual respect and trust going back and forth. And I think when I was younger and trying to make my way in the industry, I was more susceptible to that kind of thing, but it's really like being told about my weight or my looks or hair extensions or, you know, those types of things now. It doesn't have anything to do with my job. I mean, it just doesn't. I mean, as long as obviously we're working in television, right? So we have to be professional and presentable and look like we're representing the network that we're working for. And I get that, but also don't need to be told that I need to lose weight or change my hair color. It does make you question, you know, why am I here? Am I here because of the job I'm doing, or am I here because they want me to look a certain way on TV? I mean, I've been told I need my pretty girls to look pretty right before I'm going live on national television.
For Molly Karam, the answer to whether or not bosses had ever told her those things was pretty clear.
Yes, Sarah. Not at ESPN, and I'm not just saying lip service because that's where we're employed, but yes, at different points in my career. One point was definitely challenging because I was actually dealing with some health issues, so I had to take certain medications that can affect your weight. And I remember being pulled aside, and it was like, hey, you know, the boss thinks like you kind of have a weight problem, so you might want to lose a few pounds. Mm. So, you know, doing this job and how taxing it is anyway, And then on top of that, kind of dealing with some health stuff and then having that in the back of your mind. And it's different when somebody tells you that, I think, in your 30s than like when you're fresh out of college. But, yeah, and there were definitely comments made to me before about my look, like that I was kind of too ethnic and they didn't really know, like I wasn't the all-American blonde look. And then at the same time, I wasn't filling a certain quota for them. So yeah, that was interesting. I'd had people brought that up, like, we don't know what category you in, we don't know where you fit. I had people say to me before, I would only work in the urban space with like a minority audience, that like I wasn't like a mainstream enough.
Pretty tough to imagine executives telling Adam Schefter, Brian Windhorst, Stephen A. Smith, Mike Golic, any of those guys, that they don't look enough like the guy next door, and they'd probably only play to certain markets. Elle Duncan also experienced bosses trying to shape her image.
I've had bosses who have had issues with my hair. In fact, I've signed a contract before that was like, any major changes with your hair, we can talk to you about, and that we have say-so over what you wear. And I kind of unwittingly signed it and didn't realize until I complained that I was getting feedback too much about, and I was shown that in my contract, which I, you know, lesson, always read your contracts front to back.
Fortunately for her employers, Jemele Hill hasn't faced that issue.
No, and I've often thought to myself, if I ever have a conversation with somebody about that, it may be the last day that I work there. and I don't say that to threaten them. It's just that, like, I never want to have that conversation.
Thankfully, I've never had bosses tell me to change my clothes or my hair or my weight, but that doesn't mean I haven't thought about it. And I'm certain that I have not gotten jobs that I would have been great at because of how I look. Because I don't fit the stereotypes that you see on television. I'm not skinny enough and model looking enough. And I was just on Dan Le Batard's radio show, and he casually asked me how old I was after a reference I made, and I hesitated, and he said, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. And it frustrated me that I cared what my age was, because I'm happy with my life and my age and my family and everything. But I'm aware of this ticking clock on my career, even as a radio host and a writer, even though I only do some television and a lot of my work is not visual. There is this idea that at some point my time expires. The old Amy Schumer sketch, your last effable day. And I get that it's TV, but should whether or not people want to sleep with me really have an effect on whether I get to still talk about sports? It's a visual medium, but are the men talking sports getting told that one day their career will end because they don't look good enough? Kate Fagan admitted to also thinking about how she presents herself and whether or not it affects her career longevity or her career opportunities, because she doesn't always fit into the expected mold of what fans or bosses might want from a female sports reporter.
It's almost always a gendered comment based on my haircut that actually affects me. Like, oh, you'd look better with long hair, or what's up with your haircut? It does make me question, like, okay, should I do something different with my hair for a split second? Or maybe like a day I'll be like, maybe the way I'm presenting myself is actually hindering me. And maybe I would be taken, maybe I would just rise one level higher if I was embodying everything that like an average sports fan is supposed to want in this day and age. But it doesn't last very long, just because the way I've been able to even build any sort of career is trying to talk about the things that historically have made me feel insecure and confront a lot of the storylines that other people want to run away from. And so then I don't want to then, when it comes to my physical appearance, try and actually get pulled back to the norm. So I'm always fighting that battle internally, but I've never really let it actually change the way I go about my job.
As I'm sure you're starting to pick up here, there's so much more that goes into the job of being a sports reporter for women than there should be, whether that involves what you're wearing and how you look, or how other people react to how you look. Here's what Kavitha Davidson said about knowing that what people are often going to respond to is not what she said and all the work she did, but rather what she looked like when she presented it.
I often wonder if they're actually listening to what I'm saying based on the level of comments that I'm getting about my appearance. And I wish that, you know, sometimes that's why I prefer doing radio, frankly, because, you know, you have a face for radio, or, you know, you can wear whatever you want. And it really just comes down to what you're saying. Now, there are obviously going to be negative comments on that level too. But fans seem to be more preoccupied with how you look on camera, and that's at once the nature of the business, but it's also kind of an unfortunate side effect when it distracts from what you're actually trying to say.
Kate Fagan is frustrated that she sometimes lets those critics into her head.
What I have had is actually numerous times mentions on Twitter or Instagram commenting on something that I wore and making it seem as if it wasn't appropriate. And I wish I could say that I just blew those off, but there's a couple pieces of clothing that I have that I've worn on TV that someone said something, and every time I go to consider what I'm wearing next, I always look at that piece of clothing and I have not chosen it again. Mm. And now that I'm thinking about that, I think I'm going to have to wear that specific piece of clothing next time because I don't want to let that rule
exactly.
me.
For Mina Kimes, remembering some of the comments she's seen can actually affect how she prepares for further work assignments.
I remember early on when I started doing a little bit more TV, I searched my name to try to find a clip of an appearance I did on SportsCenter, and the first thing that came up was some guy had gone through and found appearances by two or three women on ESPN where we showed our legs. Literally, he, and I'm sure you've had this experience too, it was like a montage of legs, which is on his face hilarious and ridiculous, and just imagining this person sitting in front of his computer, pausing, cutting to find flashes of leg, which I like, bro, like there's a lot of free legs on the internet. You don't have to do this work. I don't know what's motivating you to put in all this time and effort, and it's ridiculous. And so my first reaction is to laugh, but then it creeps into my mind when I do dress, like, oh, how much leg am I showing? Because some dude on the internet is looking. And I don't want to satisfy his, I don't want to give him material or fodder for his weird montages. And I hate that. Like, I hate that the comments that people make to us while we try to ignore them and rise above them and not engage with them unless there's some fun to be had, they do, at least for me, I find creep into my mind on some level and affect my decision making. And that really sucks.
Even if you have a good attitude about it, and even if you try to be aware of how it's affecting you and try to protect against that, it still doesn't feel good to be, in the case of Mina Kimes, a Yale graduate who's incredibly accomplished and incredibly talented, and then realize that so much of your work is reduced to a thigh meat video or her mouth.
Okay, so I Google myself, and if you say you don't, you're a liar. And one of the prompts like that comes up is mouth, which, like, wow, to be reduced to a body part is so weird, right? And part of that comes with the territory, I guess. And, people can Google whatever they want, right? But it is interesting how having access to that interest and those queries and that kind of feedback, it does make you see yourself in a different way. And it's a conscious battle or an effort that I have to make to not let that affect who I am on television, because my goal is always to be myself.
Rebecca Harlow is also an Ivy League grad, having graduated from Princeton, where she was a heptathlete. And for a lot of women in sports who are incredibly accomplished, when they arrive on the media landscape and discover that people who don't know them presume them to be stupid or presume that they were hired because of their looks or because they slept with someone, it's really hard to adjust to being seen as just a body.
And I mean, I've certainly had my fair share of nights where I've, cried myself to sleep over comments that have been made and being sexualized and people making assumptions that I don't know what I'm doing just because I'm a woman. And that is hard. But I think it's also gotten a lot easier as you sort of build your reputation in this industry. It's harder for men to make those comments because your track record shows that you're credible and you know what you're doing when it comes to your job. And none of us would have our jobs if we didn't know what we were doing, if we weren't good at them.
Here's Kavitha on whether objectifying comments affect her on the job.
It definitely affects my state of mind. Because again, especially I'm more on the writing side, but the few times that I do that I do television, it seems that it's more amplified than the actual work that I'm doing. It is distracting for me to a point where, you know, like we were talking about before, if I'm getting ready in the morning to do television on a piece that I've been working on for 2 months, I'm spending way more time thinking about how I'm going to look instead of how I'm going to talk about this piece that I've been putting all of this work into.
Elle Duncan had ordered a dress from a rental service called Rent the Runway and had it delivered to the office, didn't have a chance to try it on before she went on air. She realized immediately that it looked a little bit lower cut on camera than it appeared in person, something that any woman knows can often be the case in pictures or on video. And there wasn't time to change, and she started seeing the comments roll in, and it affected her on the job.
So I was fully aware of the situation, right? I wasn't ignorant to it. But for 3 hours, I just got shredded. You have your boobs out and it's Easter. What is wrong with you? Jesus has risen. I mean, they were to the point where I was so incredibly uncomfortable. I stopped asking to do on-cam leads. I'm putting my hand in front of my chest, but trying to make it look like organic. And it really did. It bothered me so much that I couldn't wait to get done with the show.
Even if you don't have a slight wardrobe malfunction, you're likely to get comments you haven't solicited. Here's Rebecca Harlow again.
It's frustrating because I'm certainly not presenting myself in a way that would give off any kind of perception that I'm looking for inappropriate comments or pictures from men, but they do it anyway.
Mina Kimes' experience guest hosting First Take caused her to turn off comments on her Instagram altogether.
In December, I did First Take. The comments were, which as you, it's a different audience from some of our shows, and it's
yeah.
There's a volume of engagement, and it's in good and bad ways intense, right? And after that, some of the comments on my Instagram, my mom saw and was a little upset by, and after that, I shut down my comments, which maybe wasn't the right move, but that has kind of, for me, that sort of plays into how I use Instagram versus Twitter, which is it's such a visual medium, right? I just kind of felt like I was no longer comfortable seeing those comments. And so I decided to shut it down. And maybe that's not the best way to drive fan engagement, or maybe it's not something that I should give in on. But to go back to what we were talking about earlier, in terms of mentally navigating this, I decided it was just best for me.
Molly Karam has a similar story about navigating Twitter.
I used to go on air and then I'd like read the mentions in commercial breaks or read the mentions after the show. And I no longer do that because I feel like it's counterproductive. Initially, I thought it was a measuring stick of how you're doing on air. And I think that's inaccurate because I think half the people that are writing those type of comments are like the trolls that are living in their mother's basement. And I don't think it's representative of the world. I think it's representative of like a small group of trolls.
Like many other people in the industry, the way I interact on Twitter versus Facebook versus Instagram is all different. Instagram, to me, is a great way to have memories of my life. I think of it as a place for me, my friends, my family. And yeah, I know that there's fans on there, but I'm not trying to cultivate it for my job. I'm just giving a look at my life. And inevitably, if I post a photo in a sundress on a boat or in a tank top or something that you wouldn't normally see me wearing on camera at my job, I have to spend all day checking back on that post and deleting comments about my chest. And they're not funny. They're not smart. They're not interesting. They're literally just people writing boobs, nice boobs, B-E-W-B-Z boobs. And it's exhausting and it shouldn't be my job, but I don't want to leave them up there either because I have my family members and my friends. When I first started dating my husband, he thought that everybody on my social media accounts were friends of mine. And he thought it was odd how many men felt comfortable posting stuff that was inappropriate. And it wasn't until we started dating and he realized that they were strangers who felt comfortable posting that stuff. But that's a real difficult thing for a lot of women in the industry. How much do you do to stop it and delete? I actually had somebody on Twitter criticize a female coworker of mine for not deleting lewd comments on her Instagram, as if it was her responsibility to spend her time going through hundreds of comments and deleting anything that was inappropriate. I do that because I don't want them up there, but that's not on us. How about don't make those comments? Don't make it our responsibility to go through and clean up the mess. Molly Karam talked about what happened to her when she tried to clean up some of her Instagram comments.
If I see a comment, yeah, maybe I'll delete it. But Sarah, I'll get this. I'll delete one, and then the people will come back and start posting more. So I had to stop deleting them.
Right. Yeah.
Then it got worse. Then it's like an army of ants are coming out. And, you know, I'm like making all these comments. And where I get embarrassed more so is if it's, you know, like my 13-year-old niece is on there. Yeah. Like, I don't want her to see that kind of stuff, or, you know, family and like my cousins and that sort of thing.
Sometimes people argue that women in sports should just stay off social media. It is an incredibly naive opinion because there is so much work that gets done there. Whether that's interacting with colleagues, interacting with fans, promoting your work, promoting your stories, finding people to come on your podcast or your radio shows, being alerted to the news right away, building a brand. It's not really possible to avoid social media in the current era. And it's also victim blaming to believe that women should get off the platform because they're being abused. Stop the abuse instead. Here's Mina again on how she reacts to some of the comments.
Well, there are degrees to this, right? Because, like, sometimes a guy will say, or a woman, which I love, will say, hey, you look really nice today. I like your hair. That's fine, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, that's, yeah, there's nothing. It comes down to tone and, you know, obviously there are degrees of this. And I don't mind someone complimenting my appearance or commenting on it if it's kind. The ones who are either unkind or overtly sexual, I think you're right, what you said about the latter option, which is that they just kind of get off on the idea that we're seeing it. And again, that sort of brings up that whole social media thing where they suddenly now have access to us, right? I've tried knowing what's motivating it. I'm trying to not let them know it's been seen because I do feel that rewards that impulse. So I do a lot of muting, but it's hard because sometimes I also, and I know you feel this way too, I do feel it's useful to call them out and make an example of them just to know, A, this is something we go through,
mm-hmm.
and B, it's not acceptable because, you know, if you just mute people all your life, sometimes that message doesn't get across either. So I think it's there are a lot of things to weigh, and it's a difficult line to walk.
Jemele Hill says comments about her appearance, her clothes, or sexualizing her don't affect her on the job, but she'd be more than happy if they all went away.
It doesn't affect my work, but it's just kind of like a fly that's just buzzing around you all the time. Like, just die already is what I'm thinking of, right? You know, I hate that I have to deal with it at all. I'd rather not. I've been very good, you know, just in both my professional and personal life as well, is that I'm not going to let you're not paying rent inside my head. Like, that's just not happening. So the fact that I have to deal with it at all is the more cumbersome part. It's annoying. It's something I don't want to think about. It's something I don't even want to see. But yet I know that this is a part of the job.
Even if you manage not to have these comments affect you on the job, as I mentioned before when I told the story about the comments on my picture with the young soccer players, sometimes it's hard to not have it affect you in your personal life. Here's Kate Fagan on how, as much as you try, sometimes those comments follow you around.
The same comments I get online when I do something for ESPN, the ones that affect me is because I see them happen in the real world too. So if I get a Twitter message after being on Around the Horn, something about my haircut or that I look like Pablo Torre, which I get a lot. The reason that makes me cringe is because when I'm walking through the world, like when I'm at an airport and I have to go through TSA or when I'm like going into a bathroom, I would say every third time I either am coming into or out of a bathroom, someone will like double check that they're going into the women's room. And it really upsets me.
Mm.
And so the ways that people respond to me on ESPN, I see them responding that way in the real world. So then when I have to deal with it after being on TV, I think the two just kind of aggravate each other. So that makes it worse and worse until I just have to calm down. And even when my fiance and I started dating, one time she just was like, hey, I'm going to go check your Twitter at mentions because I miss you. And I want to see what people think about your, you know, the show you just did. And I actually had to say to her, like, please don't do that because I know that every third one is going to be, you know, Kate looks like a boy and what's her haircut? And I just was like, it's going to embarrass me if you see that. And so we actually had to have a long conversation one night. We like opened a bottle of wine, and she's like, tell me why you didn't want me to look at your Twitter at mentions. So I had to break it all down for her. Like, I don't want you to see what other people say about me, and then maybe you're going to start to think it too. And so we had to have that long conversation. And so it very much affects, not as much the day-to-day now, but it definitely at times has like creeped into my personal life.
Here's Mina Kimes again.
Especially if I've had a particularly bad experience online, right? Where it's just something really gross or mean, and then I go out into the world and I see, sometimes I just see people walking around, and men, because I'm sure you have 99.9% of the negative feedback I get is from men. I don't know if that's your ratio as well, but it's very few women saying, you suck, you're ugly, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So sometimes I carry that with me and I go out into the world, and it kind of breaks my heart knowing that these are people who are walking around. And so like, I had no idea. And it's like, suddenly finding out that this certain section of society just is hateful. And so that does affect me. And I wish it didn't. And I try to, I guess, keep in mind the fact that those people are acting in ways they would never act in real life, and that the internet has emboldened them to say things that maybe they're feeling, but they would normally suppress.
So why do so many people think it's necessary to send those comments? Here's one theory from Kate Fagan.
I mean, I always assume it's just a power play, because there are guys who, and sometimes it's women, but most of the time the feedback I've gotten is from men who think the sports world is their domain and where they have all of the knowledge. And then they see you, me, Mina Kimes, Ramona Shelburne on TV, and we're spitting lots of knowledge, and it makes them feel inferior. So all they have to come back at us with is pinpointing something about our appearance that they think they can come at us with. So to me, that's always kind of how I try to look at it. Like, all right, they feel threatened. And if they feel threatened, then I must be doing my job well. But it's very hard to keep that perspective, but that's what I try to remind myself.
I think it's also about control and power, especially when it comes to the sexual comments. They know that you'll see something. They know that you'll, even for a moment, recognize them. It's not really about believing that those comments are appreciated or well-received. Kate Fagan with more on that.
Anyone who thinks they're complimenting you, and I actually do think on the surface there's probably a good percentage of people who think, oh, well, that's a compliment. But that's because they haven't mined far enough in their own psyche to understand why they had to do it and why they had felt that was something that would be received well. And they obviously just haven't like pulled back the layers on that. But I definitely think that there are some people who believe it should be a compliment. I mean, I get more of like a gendered response than I do like a hypersexualized response. But when I do get that, I often obviously think that like, it's intended as a compliment, because there's usually like a wink or something. And so it's kind of it's a very confusing response that even internally, where I'm like, okay, there's like maybe 7% of me that feels complimented. And then the other 93% is kind of like, whoa, why is that something that we feel like is appropriate to say? But it's definitely a weird feeling.
Here's Molly Karam again on opening up her Instagram DMs for the first time and discovering tons of lewd photos.
Like the thought process of doing that. Yeah, I think how you explained it is perfect. I think it is some kind of control. Like, you're going to see this and you're going to like this. And it's just disturbing on so many levels. And I can't even make sense of it and rationalize it, nor do I want to. So that's why I just put it in this like, you're a loser category.
Right.
And you don't exist in my world. And I try to stay away from all of that, because I'd be lying to you if I'd say, like, if you don't see certain things, yeah, I'll get it like a sick feeling in my stomach.
For Jemele Hill, the comments creep into her personal life by way of her relationship with her boyfriend.
Well, I'm more aware, you know, in terms of my relationship. Like, I don't want the day to come where a guy will, you know, come up to me and compliment me on my looks and my boyfriend's right next to me, you know, like that's very awkward. And certainly there have been situations where a guy has like asked for a picture, and, you know, of course, because they're not above tagging me in all these photos, that when they take it, when they see me out in public, and it says something like, oh, you know, old boy's lucky, because you know, if he weren't there, I would have tried to holler like, what? You know, so it can get awkward.
In some ways, online comments that sexualize women, particularly when they're at their jobs, it's kind of like catcalling. It feels like no matter how many times women say that it's not a compliment, a lot of men still seem not to get it or think that being asked not to post stuff like that means that there's no longer a time or place to say something kind. There's a difference between you look pretty today and explicit comments about people's bodies or what you want to do to them. I mentioned before the story of the picture of me with the little girls. There's sort of a sick feeling in my stomach when I realize that even in those pure, innocent moments, I'm still being turned into a body part. Kavitha Davidson talked about the idea that there are moments when you feel like your sexuality is not your own. You don't get to choose. Somebody is projecting it on you.
It's never up to us when we're sexualized is the thing. We never really have that choice, right? And, you know, you mentioned when you're in a photo with little girls, I mean, Monet Davis was called a slut by a Major League Baseball player, sexualized at every age. I think she was, maybe 14 at the time. But, you know, it's really hard. It's really hard to navigate that. And also, you know, when you're growing up and you don't realize, you know, as a 14-year-old and you don't, you know, maybe you start growing boobs or you start becoming the sexual object in other people's eyes and you're not necessarily ready to handle that. I think you always kind of harken back to that moment, no matter how old you get, right? Because it never really is your choice how you're seen.
This idea that other people can see you in a way that makes you uncomfortable is something that Elle Duncan knows well from her youth.
So full disclosure, I understand too, you're large chested. I was large chested. I had a breast reduction because when I was in high school. Because
slapping God in the face. No, I'm just kidding.
I know. My husband to this day is like, why did you do this? But honestly, it was psychological. It was so many years of, I could wear a sweater and like you'd walk by someone and they'd be like, God damn. I'm like, oh my God. Like you couldn't do anything. I couldn't run without dudes laughing. I couldn't participate in gym without everyone watching. It was always the focus was my body, was my chest. And for me, when I was 16, 17 years old, it just was too much for me. And I thought, if I eliminate this, if I take away these big boobs, then at the very least, the focus is off of my body. Well, little did I know that I would just get older and that, as most women, we would just continue to be objectified because if you have smaller boobs, then you get objectified for that. Why don't you take some of that fat from your ass and put it in your chest? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's always something. I just wasn't equipped for that emotionally when I was younger to handle it. It just was too much for me.
I remember when I was about 14 or 15, I went with my track coach and some of my track teammates to a high jumping competition. It was the world's best high jumpers were in town. And I was wearing a long sleeved polo shirt with a collar. It was jade green. And I was jogging down the stairs to get back to my group. And like I said, 14, 15, I was very tall. And a man who was probably in his late 20s, early 30s said, can you go back up to the top of the stairs and do that again? And it took me a minute to even know what he was saying. I hadn't even kissed a boy yet. And I was a total tomboy. And I was definitely still adjusting to the idea that I even had boobs. And I didn't see myself as a sex object. I was just a kid. But because I was tall, because I had big boobs, men already saw me a certain way. And I think the reason that I remember that word for word and the feeling of shame that I had, even though I had done nothing, is because I think sometimes that feeling still stays with me. And maybe this is a little TMI, it's a little vulnerable admission, but I think it's important to share that even someone like me who carries herself very confidently at times still feels like that 15-year-old who was uncomfortable being looked at in a certain way. When women tell you that it doesn't make them feel good when you say stuff like that, they're not lying. For some of us, it's really uncomfortable for us to know that anywhere we go in the world, as we walk through the spaces around us, no matter what we're wearing, who we're with, what we're doing, how we feel, that we can still be just reduced to sex. That's really uncomfortable. Not just because you might be someone who doesn't really like that attention, but also because there's a lot of very real violence associated with men and women and sexual urges, power urges, desire for control. And the idea that you could walk around the world and at any moment have somebody looking at you in that way is disconcerting. It's unsettling. Dave Chappelle did a bit on one of his most recent comedy specials describing the moment that he sort of understood what it's like to be a woman walking around in this world. And it was a time when he had $30,000 of cash on him and he's sitting on a train thinking to himself, if anybody knew that at this moment I had $30,000 cash on me, I would be immediately attacked. And he said, that's probably what it feels like to walk around with a vagina. It was a moment of real understanding, I think, for him. And the key is to get people to understand, right? It's not just to admonish, but to hopefully get people to understand where we're coming from. So I asked the women, what would you tell men to try to explain to them that even if you think it's a compliment, when you get too detailed, when you target specific body parts, when you describe things you would want to do to us, it's not a compliment and it doesn't make us feel good. Here's Kate Fagan.
Well, it doesn't feel remote and distant. It doesn't feel like a random person 2,500 miles away just making an offhand comment. It feels to me, and I'm getting better at not taking it so much to heart, but it feels like somebody sitting next to you making that comment.
Here's Jamel Hill.
You know, what I would tell them is that, you know, they have to understand that, you know, an obsession with our looks is really off-putting and disconcerting. It's that, you know, I'm not the pinup that in the magazine, all right? Like, you know, that's not the function of my job. The function of my job is to discuss sports and to be knowledgeable and to execute journalism. It's like, it's not to be your personal, you know, kind of pinup. And I think men believe sometimes that giving us, you know, compliments and obsessing about our physical appearance is a compliment to us, but it's actually more of an ego feed for them. And I think they kind of need to understand what the difference is. And of course, I'm sure that there'll be thousands of men who are like, oh, so we can't even compliment men and women anymore. Like, that's not the point. It's that most women know how to receive a compliment. And we understand the general function of flattery. I get that. But it's that there's a lot of guys who take it too far, or they're overly sexualizing us. That gives us a level of discomfort. And we may look like we're laughing it off, but trust me, on the inside, most of us are cringing.
Jamel mentioned something specific. She said, we're not your pinups. And I can't tell you how many times on Twitter someone has said, you remind me of fill in the blank. And then I Google the name and it's a porn star. Do you understand the absurdity of being a sports reporter? Not even a model or actress that's put in positions of being sexualized for a character or for a calendar shoot or something. I go on the radio and on TV and I talk about sports, and somehow that's still the way their brain sees me. And I think, once again, that just plays into the idea of not feeling like you can escape from what people see your body as, no matter what you say or do, no matter how much I present myself as someone who wants to make you laugh and make you think and not someone who wants to turn you on. That's still how I'm going to be seen. And look, I know this is not specific to female sports reporters. This is the female condition. We cannot separate women from their bodies. I asked Kavitha Davidson what she would tell men about why it doesn't feel good to be talked about that way, particularly on the job.
Well, so first of all, the on the job part is the most important thing, right? Like, we're professionals and we do this for a living, and we're not doing this in order to project our images or our bodies. So I think I would just like to get that point across to people, that even if you think you're complimenting us, you're not complimenting us on what we would actually like to be complimented on.
At first, Molly Karam thought trying to help out some of these men might be a bit of a lost cause, but then she came around and tried to figure out what she might say to them.
Like, if we're talking about some of the comments, like, nice, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
And they think they're being nice.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, Sarah. Where do you begin? I feel like I should go back to when they were in diapers. To think that that's what a woman wants to hear. Like, about, you know, I don't know. I guess I would try to articulate the fact that I'd like them to, like, recognize, of course, I think it's nice if someone says you look beautiful, or, like, you know, you look attractive, or I like your outfit, that kind of thing. Sarah, I truly don't know. I don't even know where I would begin with that kind of person. Like, if they don't know that and they're an adult age, but I guess I would just try to explain that if they're a fan and, like, they are a supporter and they appreciate our work, that kind of thing, that is, you know, that's counterproductive.
Here's Mina Kimes and what she would like them to know.
I think I would, and I've tried to reason to these people on social media, and I've realized I've just kind of given up, because most people who will say extremely negative or sexual things don't want to be reasoned with. They want our attention, right? So I've kind of given up on that. But I do believe it can work in real life, which is very different. And when someone is forced to confront the emotional ramifications of what they say. Mm-hmm. It's a very different interaction. And so what I would say is, assuming it's a positive thing, right? Because if it's a negative thing, that's saying altogether. But if somebody says something sexual, positive, whatever, I would say, hey, like, I know you mean this as a compliment, but it actually makes me feel bad. And here's why. And here's why it affects the way I live my life and do my job. And I would try to explain my experience to them in a way that they could understand. Men and women don't really have those conversations. You know, outside of this crazy job we have and the world we inhabit, it's not a conversation that happens a lot. And I wish it happened more often.
My final question for the women was a tough one. And I acknowledge that, because trying to fix this problem in the sports industry means trying to address it at a larger level. If we're not able to separate women from their bodies in society, then why would we expect women to be treated as beings instead of objects in the sports world, particularly a male-dominated sports world? But the answer, of course, is not to just say this is part of the job. It's not a part of the job for male sports reporters to be compared to porn stars, to have people telling them what sex acts they'd like to do to them, to have people sending lewd photos to them. So it's not part of the job, then. It's part of being a woman on the job. And if we seek equality and if we seek similar work experiences and similar work conditions for men and women, then we should at least do our best to try to come up with answers for the problem. Here's what Molly Karam thought about addressing the issue.
You know, as far as the objectification, the only thing that I could be hopeful of is that, like, so, you know, if we're having these conversations and then, you know, we're raising sons, and like, as the, I think that's more of like generations down the road. I know that's kind of a depressing answer, but like, now we're able to talk about it. We're empowered as women to have these discussions, these important discussions like you're initiating here. And I think it's just, it's not just raising women, it's raising men to also like look at us and respect us in that manner. And I think that's when it changes.
Mina Kimes also hopes things will get better over time, and she believes part of the fix is to make women more visible, more omnipresent in the industry, particularly as opinion givers and not just facilitators.
Well, I think normalizing us being places, right, is, I mean, you and I, the number of female opinionators, analysts, is still small. And I think that's part of the reason why we're treated differently and compared, which is bizarre, right? Like, I always find it funny, Sarah, when you and I are compared, which is a lot, which is, like, I am much more similar to, like, Pablo in a lot of ways. And you would think that would be, no, but you know what I mean? Like, that would be the natural comparison, I believe. But unfortunately, because there's so few women, and because men are more comfortable evaluating their physical appearance and talking about them in, I think, a superficial way, we get treated differently. And I think if there were simply more of us and it became much more normal to turn on a show or turn on the radio and a woman is, you know, the presence of women there is expected and not surprising, I think that would change the way that we're viewed. And it would result, I think, in men evaluating us more on our ideas. Right? Especially if we're in roles where our primary job is to express those ideas. I mean, I love it when guys are like, you're wrong, you know? DeAndre Ayton's number one pick. Great. Criticize me for my ideas. Criticize me the way you criticize the men that I work with. Tell me my takes are wrong. That's fine. I just want to be evaluated in the same way as anyone else.
Kavitha Davidson agrees that normalizing women in the industry is one of the keys.
It's a very slow and long process. It starts, first of all, with having more women on air, to be honest, and just normalizing that space for us, right? It also, you know, it goes back to the idea that, and not even our bodies, right? When Beth Mowins was calling her first game, people were commenting on the fact that a female's voice was doing play-by-play, and that was weird for them, right? It's literally just the presence of us in these spaces that people aren't used to us being in. So the more of us that occupy these spaces, I think, normalizes that and can help mitigate some of those circumstances.
Rebecca Harlow acknowledges that things have already gotten better since she started out in the industry, but she feels that there will always be people who believe it's their right to objectify and sexualize those in the spotlight.
I think it's changed a lot. When I started in this business, when you started in this business till now, things have changed a lot. And so I don't run into these issues as much as I existed before when women in the industry was still kind of a rare thing. So I do think it's changing, but unfortunately, I think that to some degree that will always be there in the sense that, you know, we chose public professions and it's not just our industry, it's all industries. If you choose to put yourself in a public spotlight, whether it's, you know, politics or TV or entertainment or anything, you're going to be subjected to that. And I don't know that that will ever truly change.
Kate Fagan agrees that it's hard to imagine a world in which female sports reporters aren't sexualized, in part because the issue is so predominant all over society.
It's not as if you could say, oh, well, like 20 years ago, it was, you know, so much worse and we've made a lot of progress. I think we definitely have made progress in terms of, I think, women's voices being heard and respected in certain ways. But with other avenues that our culture has gone down, like with porn industry and the hypersexualization and the issues that that has brought up, I can't say that I think that we're raising a generation of kids who then are going to like respect women, because I think we have issues that are happening in other parts of the culture. So I don't know that it matters how frequently we have the conversation in the sports industry, because most 99% of our audience are people who are just parachuting in to watch something and they're not privy to different posts that or magazine articles or even podcasts like this one where we might be trying to talk about it and understand it more. So I can't say right now that I'm like, I can see like a few things at play right now where I think it's going to make it better. I think this is going to be something that's going to be going on for a very long time.
Elle Duncan said the real solution lies in having conversations with men and putting the onus on them to help encourage change.
I had heard this a few months ago and it really resonated with me, and I feel like it's applicable for this as well, in that, you know, we don't need white politicians coming to black churches telling us that they're not racist. We need white politicians going to other white churches and telling them that they're not racist, right? And I feel like, unfortunately, women are charged to do everything. Like, we're charged with coming up with the solution to the objectification and misogyny and all of those things that come along with being a woman. Like, that isn't, like, the men have to figure that out, you know? Mm. What can we do? Because if you try to make it about anything but how you look, it ultimately comes back to how you look every time. You know, well, I respect this person because this person isn't hot, but they're really smart.
Right.
Or I respect this person because they're hot and they're smart. Mm-hmm. Or I respect this person because they're really hot and they don't shy away from the fact that they're not smart. It always begins and ends with that. It always starts with that. And, you know, I feel like as a woman, like, why do we have to figure it out alone? You know, like, this is a question men need to be asking themselves. What will it take for you to stop viewing us in this way? What will it take for you to start, you know, figuring out that we deserve equitable pay? Like, what's your solution to this? Because you're the ones that view us in this way. So in your opinion, what needs to change for that to happen? And because for me, it doesn't seem like the world's biggest question. It seems really easy. Look at me for who I am, you know, in the same way that you enjoy our male counterparts because of their opinions or their views, or you don't, view me in the same way. That's all I'm asking for.
Jemele Hill rightly says that it will require a multifaceted approach to make any progress.
I don't think it's just one solution. I think it's many solutions. I do think that the television industry has to help us out by not themselves feeding into it, by focusing on that or playing up to it, or in this case, I guess, playing down to that kind of lowest common denominator, because a lot of what, you know, men and the male audience or some of the male audience think it's okay is because there are constantly decisions made in TV to support that they think that that's okay. So that's number one, is that on our side professionally, we have to do a better job of not trying to placate to that kind of audience. And, you know, I think it's okay to keep having these conversations, even to the point of making some men uncomfortable about what the fascination and fixation with that appearance, what that feels like. I mean, people tend to have more empathy and understand situations when you tell them, like, hey, that made me uncomfortable, that was awkward, sort of putting them in our shoes a little bit, or even our high heels, if you will. I think that also is very helpful. And as I've had one-on-one conversations with men about this over the years, they seem to get it in that regard. So I think that's also, you know, very helpful. And women, we have to empower each other. I mean, it can be tough because obviously we want to be a presence on TV. We want to stay on TV. So we understand the job that needs to be done, but I think we shouldn't be fixated on each other's looks either, because I've certainly heard other women in the business who say something about something that a woman is wearing on TV or whatever. That's, you know, kind of very critical. I think we got to stop doing it to each other and empower ourselves as much as possible. So there's a lot of layers to it. I mean, I don't know if it's something that will exist. It feels like in some form of it will always exist, because unfortunately that's just the world that we live in. But I definitely think that there are steps that we can take to at least try to diminish the problem, although I don't know if it'll ever be fully eradicated.
One of those steps is just talking to each other and listening to each other. So thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Hopefully some of the perspectives and insight from the women that joined me stuck with you, and you'll take them out into the world and share them and influence others and educate others and get conversation going about some of these issues. Thanks again to Mina Kimes, Kate Fagan, Molly Karam, Rebecca Harlow, Jamel Hill, Elle Duncan, and Kavitha Davidson for their great insights.
Oh, and another thing.
Couple stories for this week's That's What She Read that relate to the topic. The first one is from the Boston Globe last year. The headline is, "For at least a decade, women broadcasters have been pushed to look sexier on air." The author is Beth Teitel, T-E-I-T-E-L-L. Here's a bit from the story. Off the record, current and former female broadcasters in Boston tell stories about wardrobe consultants hired by station management pushing clothing that some on-air talent didn't want to wear. Women crying in the makeup room because they felt pressured to dress a certain way. A modestly dressed anchor being asked to dress like a sexier new colleague who wore her skirts short and her tops unbuttoned. One former local on-air personality told the Globe she was once called into her news director's office and told the blazer she had worn the day before wasn't shapely enough. He said it was too boxy, she said. The journalist said she shot back, letting him know his critique was inappropriate and offensive, but didn't report the incident. "Honestly, I didn't feel the culture would support me complaining, so I didn't go beyond him," she said. "Much of what goes on is more subtle," she said. "It's not like there's a casting couch. No one would put up with that. This is so murky because appearance is part of your job. They can be very subjective about how you move up and down the ladder." Another story comes from the Women's Media Center. The headline is, "The hypersexualization of female news broadcasters proves sexism is alive and well." It just says, as the author Claire B., but you can find it on womensmediacenter.com using that headline. It's a story that I was surprised to find myself quoted in, but here's a little segment. "While it might seem that female journalists who meet these beauty standards have power in this industry, this power is actually precarious. Walking the tightrope between being sexy and getting by on one's looks is a challenge itself. You can't win either way," ESPN's Sarah Spain once said about the struggle to strike a balance between looks and qualifications. "Either you're too beautiful and you don't know what you're talking about, or you're too ugly and I don't want to watch you." Finding a middle ground is actually altogether impossible, according to Wolf, who's previously quoted in the story. "Women can be talented and quote-unquote unbeautiful and therefore invisible and their merit rendered irrelevant, or beautiful and achieve visibility but without receiving credit for their merit," she posited. "What's more, success is still limited even for those who are beautiful because upon aging, quote, they disappear." Both good stories, and there are plenty more out there on the topic if you're interested. Thanks as always for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.